The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
We are not here to necessarily talk about kind of Irish holidaymakers, but rather politics, local and national politics in this country, because tomorrow is polling day. I say tomorrow is polling day. Tomorrow really is kind of the last day of polling, because it's remarkable in this country how many people vote early. It's both local and national here, because tomorrow is polling day. Rather, the last day of polling is probably how I should describe it, given how many people vote early. Tens of millions of people have literally already cast their votes in this country. Joining me to talk about, you know, where things might go, what the issues are on the ground, what exercises voters in this country, in this city as well, gives me great, great pleasure to welcome to the show Ellen Ionas, who is a news reporter with Vox. Ellen, pleasure to meet you. Thanks a million for coming in to us here in Fitzpatrick's. And Bridget Berrigan, senior politics reporter and host with WNYC on New York Public Radio. Bridget, good to see you as well.
Great to
Thanks
be here.
A million for coming in to us. So listen, I mean, it would be unfair probably to ask you, how's it all going to go, is it? Would it be, Ellen?
That is very quite cruel, actually. Polls are extremely close at all levels, whether we're talking about the president or talking about Congress. Everything's extremely, it's a very, very tight race.
And what are those polls telling us in terms of, like, how have they moved over the course of the campaign, put it that way?
Well, it's been a really eventful campaign, because certainly, you know, when President Biden was running, there was, you know, there was not a lot of excitement around Biden. You know, incumbents have not done well in elections, you know, across the board throughout the world this year. So people were not as excited about him. And then, you know, when Harris announced that she would be taking over, there was quite a big bump for Harris. And it sort of depends on what issue you're asking people about. But Harris has, people have gotten more interested in Harris's economic ability to handle the economy. People have more confidence in that now, we've seen. But, you know, it's really settled back overall into like a really neck and neck space, except for one outlier poll that came down over the weekend. But it's really been quite neck and neck.
And Bridget, you know, how different then are issues kind of state by state? Or like put it this way, because you'd have a focus on kind of New York and New York issues. And do they reflect the national issues, or are there kind of local things that sway the presidential vote in any particular area?
There are states that tend to vote more, as we say, you know, red Republican or blue Democratic. There are only a handful of swing states that most people are watching to determine who will actually win this race. Just about seven states, and those states are as close as any. And part of, you know, as Ellen was saying, what is so interesting in these final days in terms of the final polling, this outlier poll that she referred to was from the state of Iowa, which is not considered a swing state by any means, and showed a uptick for Vice President Harris that I think people are not expecting. And if you do look more closely at the details of some of the final polls that show ultimately the potential results being very close, there are some things to be paying attention to as we try to understand, you know, as you said, voting concludes tomorrow, since 78 million people have already voted during early voting. And that is a massive gender gap in this election, where women in particular are tending to skew towards Vice President Harris, and older women even more so. And, you know, it's an important detail to keep in mind, because in the previous election, white women voters in particular, which make up a very significant voting bloc, went for former President Donald Trump. The polling is suggesting potentially that that may not be the case in this election. So I think that's one of the things that people will be looking at in the final days. And so then you compound, if you look at that in the context of issues, this is the first presidential election that we have had since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned what was, you know, a federal right to abortion access. The Dobbs decision was a Supreme Court case. It overturned a precedent that had been in place for 30 years, Roe v. Wade. And in the elections we've seen
50 years.
In the elections we've seen since then, when ballot amendments have been put to voters about reproductive health care and enshrining abortion right, those people have come out in huge numbers in support of those initiatives. There are 10 states this year that have abortion amendments on the ballot, including the state of New York. And so that is one of the things that could be a driver for getting people to the polls.
It's interesting you say that, because, you know, I was out and about yesterday evening and this morning speaking to people, and again, this is not a scientific poll. This is literally just the people who will stop and talk to me on the street. But any woman I spoke to who has cast their vote or was going to cast their vote for Vice President Harris, that was the reason why. It wasn't the border, it wasn't crime, it wasn't the economy, not that they're not considering that every single part. Now, that's just, again, not suggesting it's scientific, but it echoes the point you're making that is kind of evident in those national polling figures, that reproductive rights is the big issue. But if the polling is so close, I get Trump must be kind of have sucked up support from elsewhere then, Ellen, that he maybe didn't necessarily have before. Is that fair?
Well, I think that there are lots of conversations around young men, particularly, and then, let's say, men of color coming over to the Republican side. So Latino men, Black men, and there, I think, have been lots of questions, and there's been a lot of digging into whether Trump has really, you know, picked up those voters who are maybe have different values around, you know, women's rights and reproductive rights, potentially, who are dissatisfied in other ways, in economic ways. And, you know, there are, I think the voter is a lot more emotional and complex than we tend to think. You know, we tend to think like, oh, this issue, this person should vote for their economic interest, or this person should vote this particular way because they're this particular kind of person. That's not how it works.
Politics is the same in Ireland, whether it's kind of party political politics or it's kind of referendums on issues. People make an emotional connection to an issue or an outcome or a person, and it's on that basis that they went. And clever politicians realize this, and they play on that emotional connection effectively.
But ultimately, we won't know about that until, you know, at least tomorrow or potentially Wednesday or Thursday, because we might not have the result until Wednesday or Thursday or even later. Like in 2020, the election was not officially called for Biden until the weekend following election day. So it will take some time to go through all of those votes and to see who it is who voted. And, you know, as we know that older people tend to vote early, women tend to vote early. You know, younger people tend to come out at the last second. So, you know, then we'll have a better understanding about who's going where. But you do see, I mean, I've seen, you know, plenty of young, or I shouldn't say plenty, but some young men with Make America Great Again hats on. And, you know, that doesn't mean that all younger men are going for Trump, but like it, and I don't know that it necessarily represents a huge difference from 2020, let's say, but you know, as we were saying, voting is hugely emotional for a lot of people.
And listen, I want to, because I know a lot of your beat is kind of foreign policy, and I want to talk about maybe kind of the differences between both candidates, what they might mean in terms of foreign policy. But Bridget, kind of one aspect, I guess, that gets completely overlooked from an Irish point of view is maybe kind of those down ballot races. We'll just focus on the big thing, the Oval Office and who's going to be in it for the next 4 years. But the power that that person has to kind of implement their policy agenda is determined by those down ballot races. And actually, I didn't realize that I came here. New York is kind of going to be interesting on that front.
New York is going to be very interesting. You know, the House Minority Leader, Hakeem Jeffries, is from here in Brooklyn. Democrats are looking at flipping seats in New York in particular, and Republicans are looking very much to hold on to seats that they flipped in 2022. There were about seven seats that the nonpartisan Cook Political Report has rated as competitive in varying degrees across New York. And those seats, you know, if Republicans hold on to them, they are likely to retain control of the House of Representatives, which is, you know, crucial to any president, their ability to put their agenda into action. And if Democrats are successful in flipping any of those seats, that could make Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries the first African-American speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. So there's a lot of history-making potential here in New York, a lot of very competitive races. Millions and millions of dollars are being spent. You cannot turn on the television without seeing an ad. I was walking through the hotel here in the bar, seeing an ad for the 4th Congressional District, which is right out on Long Island, nearby. Very competitive race. I've spent a lot of time there.
And you know, sorry, to kind of overlap a little with kind of the first question I asked you, but I was watching those ads as well with great interest. And what I kind of found fascinating is I expected them to be talking about, I mean, if this was kind of Ireland, they'd be talking about kind of the broken lamps along the kind of the main street in Brooklyn or whatever it happened to be. They were talking about the border. It's like, I mean, it's a couple of thousand miles away.
Yeah, these races have taken on the national narrative and adapted it for, you know, their specific constituency. So the issue of, you know, an influx of migrants to New York, which has become an issue very much here in the city, but then even more so an issue or a talking point in the surrounding suburbs. It's something that candidates have spoken about very aggressively. We saw it, you know, earlier this year. There was a special election. There was a member of Congress who was historically expelled. His name was George Santos. You might have heard of him. Sort of a notable character, currently under indictment and, you know, faces a trial and potential, you know, prison, et cetera. But the race to fill his seat was kind of the first preview we saw of how Democrats might be tacking more centrist and then taking an issue like the border and really throwing it back at Republicans, because there was this bipartisan border deal that had been developed in Congress that, you know, one of the most conservative members of Congress had helped work on along with Democrats. It was something that people thought might move. And then former President Trump came out and said, he was going to oppose it. He was urging members to oppose it. It was a more potent political issue for him during the presidential campaign to not address it through this particular reform. And so they didn't. But then immediately, in this particular case, the Democrat Tom Suozzi seized on it and really threw it back at his Republican opponent in a way that worked and was relatively salient in that special election, and we've seen repeated throughout some of these other congressional districts.
So, Ellen, from a foreign policy point of view, well, first of all, let me ask you this. Are there any voters out there who get exercised by the foreign policy positions of the candidates? Are there many voters?
There are not many voters, but I will say that because, you know, I think there are, well, that's not totally true, because we have seen a large uncommitted movement here in the United States, and that's about Gaza.
Yeah.
And so that has really been something that has animated a significant constituency. We have a lot of Arab American voters, which understandably that is a massive issue for them. And it's made the fact that Harris has not really specifically condemned the killing of tens of thousands of Palestinians, has vowed to support Israel, probably not in the same way as her predecessor, but she hasn't very specifically pointed out, you know, here's how we would want to limit Israel, here's what we would do, or she hasn't publicly done this. She hasn't publicly said, you know, we are going to pursue an end to the war. We are going to aggressively pursue peace negotiations, and we are willing to put leverage behind it to do that. So that has certainly animated a good portion of people, and but it will, like, it could possibly influence people not to vote.
So let's imagine for a moment then, in the first instance, a Harris presidency after Tuesday. What will that mean for U.S. foreign policy and its interaction with other countries around the world?
Well, I think a lot of countries are really preparing for a Trump presidency because they were caught quite off guard in 2016. And the biggest or one of the biggest issues is around trade. Trump has said he wants to impose tariffs, 60% on goods coming from China and 10 to 20 for goods coming from other places. And that was something that started a trade war with China during his first presidency. And the EU is really preparing for that. I know that that's a really salient issue in Ireland because of the high levels of trade, high levels of foreign direct investment. Now, if Harris wins, I think that she is a big proponent of multilateralism. So she, you know, she doesn't have this quite as jingoistic, sensibility as Trump. And I think it's, you know, any Democrat is not going to be quite as, you know, dare I say, like, highly nationalistic.
What would a Trump presidency mean in the short term for Ukraine?
No, I don't think so. Trump has said that he would bring this war to an end, like immediately, before he's even installed in the Oval Office. But that depends on bringing Vladimir Putin to the negotiating table, which he's not inclined to do. There's no sign that he is really, truly interested in negotiating over Ukraine. And, you know, why would he negotiate at this point? It doesn't really make a lot of sense for him. So Trump, now there are strong possibilities that aid to Ukraine would be cut, not totally, but significantly. It would be walked, really slow walked, and that could be very harmful for Ukraine.
Yeah, which I guess brings us back to kind of the congressional point, because a lot of those decisions kind of happen in Congress, and so kind of those down ballot races. The big issue. Listen, there's so many layers to this. We could talk until the cows come home, as we say, about it. But unfortunately, listen, we're out of time. I thank you both very much for coming down to us here in Fitzpatrick's Hotel in Manhattan.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.